This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick, and my brother, Chris. In this episode, spreading out of control. In the past few years, child and adolescent physicians have seen a huge spike in behavioral disorders associated with tics and twitches. The tics mimic telltale signs of Tourette's syndrome. But unlike people with actual Tourette's, these new patients were caught up in a loop. They were either consciously or unconsciously faking their symptoms, and in some cases, they couldn't stop. The outbreak of these cases appears to be a direct result of young, impressionable people watching content made by influential patients with Tourette's. The young people would watch the videos and then get psychosomatically infected with a disease they couldn't possibly have. It's been called an echo pandemic among primary physicians. But this is hardly the first time this kind of thing has happened. A few decades ago, people reported symptoms of a bug bite they couldn't possibly have. And of course, in Salem, Massachusetts, it's possible people mirrored symptoms that they also couldn't possibly have, which led to the Salem witch trials. The idea is called social contagion, and it deals with how ideas spread and infect people. We'll also talk about the spheres of influence, the Salem witch trials, and our experience triangle, trying to understand how people can have symptoms of diseases they simply cannot have. Welcome to episode 89. Of Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, decision-making, and social networks in the last year or two. Chris, we're doing another one of those today about how we interact with the people, not the world around us, but also the people in the world around us.
You know, it is pretty shocking how often social networks crop up. It's almost like I have this theory that human beings are kind of like animals, but we're social. It's almost like we're social animals.
I think is the way.
Social animals.
If I had to coin an original phrase, I would describe us that way.
Sure. I think you have something there. I think that I don't know that you do, but I think if you brought it to a professor, they might be of some interest.
I think they would praise me for my originality, because I'm sure nobody has ever thought of that.
No, I don't think anyone has ever thought of that. I think that's going to be all you. I think academia could be your future.
You know, it feels good to be alone at the top. And Player 3, I want to thank you for supporting me on my journey there.
Welcome to our first, second autumnal episode. It's the best time of year in America. It is the greatest.
Yeah, we're officially in autumn as of, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple of days ago. It's the 22nd, right?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a calendar.
So. Yeah, I don't know either, but it's the best. It's finally starting to cool down a little bit. Where I am and where you are, and we gotta talk about our favorite fall things again. I just love fall. I gotta find some new fall things, because the greatest thing about fall is every now and then you find something new, but usually it's just like the same 12 things, and you're like, yeah, I love everything about this.
Everything's awesome. It the air feels crisper. Although I want to shout out to our Midwestern Player 3 contingent.
Yeah.
Apparently it's been really, really hot, like unseasonably hot in the Great Lakes, all the way down into like St. Louis and the Ozarks. It's been super hot in the middle of the country. So kudos to you for, tolerating that garbage. I couldn't stand it. I can barely stand it as it is.
Yeah.
Every summer, right around August, I'm thinking, you know what? It's time to move. It's time for me to get to Minnesota or like Manitoba or something.
Yeah. I saw that at the University of Wyoming football game, the field temperature, and those fields get really hot because of the rubber, and they conduct heat, but they don't really get rid of it. It's like 117.
They're not conductors. They're good insulators. So the heat gets in there and it gets trapped.
So it was 117 degrees at the University of Wyoming in a game in September on the field, at the field temperature, which is crazy.
That's crazy.
It's completely unacceptable. Irregardless, it is. And as we record this, we are only a day or two away from the large national security test that's going to happen on all of our phones, which is our dad's birthday. That'd be exciting for him.
Yeah. Happy birthday, old man.
Yeah. Happy birthday to the
I hope the test goes well. I hope you remember the test if you're listening to this.
Yeah.
And I hope you don't absolutely pay. I hope you spend the entirety of the test outside in the pool relaxing.
Yeah, I hope he does. I hope he does too. Okay, before we get to social contagion and how people have been catching Tourette's from the internet, and they have kind of been catching Tourette's from the internet, so to speak, for hundreds of years. Before we do that, I want some things that we want to talk about. We're going to do an episode soon on the Delta Sky Miles fiasco and then all of these different rewards programs and like the idea that it's better to... I support local coffee shops for two reasons. Reason number one, they're local and I like that. Reason number two is that they do purchase-based rewards instead of money-based rewards. So every 10th purchase, I get a free one. Instead of every $10, I get $1. As you can tell right there by me saying that out loud, that's a big difference. So we're going to do a whole episode on that, and I'm really excited about it. I also have updates on Tinder, Chris. Remember, we've done the dating game a number of times.
Tinder is
piloting a mega elite thing for, like, I don't know what benefits it's going to get people. And remember, they want you to meet people on these apps like Hinge and Bumble. False. They want you to spend money. They're offering an elite package that's like five or six hundred a month.
Are you kidding me?
That's like a car payment.
Guys, if you feel compelled to pay $500 a month to try to get matches online, I highly suggest going back to the Internet Archive and looking up Club Penguin, because that was the original social networking site. If you're lonely, that will cure your loneliness.
Oh,
it'll wash away your boredom. Go to Club Penguin.
Yes. And we never...
Don't pay $500.
And so
this is Tinder that's doing this?
Tinder, which is the Match Group, which is Match.com and a number of other apps and meeting sites. Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
My goodness.
So Tinder is the one.
Please don't buy that Player 3.
Tinder is a little bit more sexually motivated and a little bit more hookup-y, not as many real relationships. Many people got married and are in committed relationships from Tinder from the early days, but it's a little bit more of that. So I think that that's sort of the motivation here. It's like an exclusive club. I don't know that this would work for the other more serious apps like Bumble or Hinge, but yeah, they're doing it, which is disappointing. You're going to tell me what the Penguin Club is here in a minute, but before we get to that, I have some more things to catch up on, which is that in our Taylor Swift episode, we discussed a little bit. Many people covered this, so we decided not to. The secondary market for her tickets and how Ticketmaster was kind of allowing this crazy scalping situation where you could buy something for $600 and then sell it for like $12,000, these tickets to her concerts. It was a high demand. People were standing outside the stadiums. Who can afford to go? Well, now the IRS is well aware of the situation, and they have all of this information is super look upable, and they will be coming after people who did not report their insane boondoggle from reselling their Taylor Swift tickets. So if you didn't report on your taxes how much money you made reselling T-Swift tickets, the IRS is, of course, instead of auditing, I don't know, Jeff Bezos or somebody, they're going to come after people reselling T-Swift tickets, which is both good and annoying, but good. I like that. Like, if you screw people, like, the Taylor Swift money teat is big enough for all of us. The NFL has made that very clear. So the IRS is going to come with their hand out too.
The resale scam reminds me of people who went out and preempted the panic buying of the pandemic in February and March, and they bought cases and cases of stuff like water and ass wipe and all that good stuff. And then they tried to resell it on eBay. If you resell Taylor Swift tickets for the purpose of making money, starting your own little business, and then don't report that income to the IRS, I'm sorry. I can't respect that.
No.
It's taking advantage of a grift, and you know, you deserve to be, I don't know, bitten by a lot of mosquitoes before summer fully ends. Mm. I don't know. Maybe you deserve to drive over a thumbtack and have your tire pressure slowly decrease by like one PSI every couple days.
A really big, fat, non-venomous spider in your house that you can't reach, that you can see, but you can't reach. So you have to go to bed.
And
before bed.
You swear you got him that one time.
Yep.
You swear you got him, but you didn't quite tell, and you didn't check the paper towel before 100%. You threw it away. Yep. And you think, oh my God, are there more of these things? But it's not like dangerous, but it's there.
At like 11:30 at night, that happens you have to go to sleep. Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hope you never get another moment of feeling of safety from that spider, that safe, non-venomous spider in your home.
Absolutely. 100%. One other quick note, NFTs are essentially useless now. Wow, that's crazy. Who could have saw that coming?
Can we go back in the archive and pull some footage of us calling the hell out of that?
We have had some good calls that are unique, but that one was not unique. Everybody's like, what if you just took a screenshot?
No, we were just two guys in a long line of people saying that this is an obvious grift, and if you buy it, you are a sucker.
Exactly. So, yeah, Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift, a lot. We could talk about that all day. And but one thing I do want to talk about Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift is we see that the NFL's viewership is going up. Young girls and women are going up, like 50% increase in female viewers. And what's happening with this is that we're having a bit of a cultural moment. And that kind of leads us into what we're talking about today, which is that when does something become a fever pitch? When is it a moment? And then when do people become a little obsessed with something? So we know that the 99% of my T-Swift and Travis Kelce, which I'm working on a couple name for them, I'm thinking it's going to be Trailer.
Trailer?
Well, I mean, that's funny.
Are you kidding me?
I saw
Trailer.
There was someone had a jersey on that said Swelsey, like Swift and Kelce. Like, no.
Swelsey.
What if we went with
that? Sounds
quit?
Like that sounds like
I like quit.
The Kelce brothers, like new workout Swelsey. Company.
They would sell that a lot. I'm seeing all this on TikTok. Absolutely. All these news and people, and there was an article written by Bon Appetit that said there was a report from someone on Twitter that she's having a chicken finger with a ketchup and quote seemingly ranch, which is hilarious. This is the funniest thing that's ever come to us. But we see this kind of thing take off, and that leads us to when people can kind of have a moment. One of the cool things about the TikTok algorithm is things can go viral and people know what you're talking about, and it's a fun moment. People will remember Couch Guy. And if you don't remember that, but you can look it up yourself. Couch Guy.
I do remember Couch Guy. Yeah, when that girl walks into the college dorm. He's not alone.
Right, exactly. But because the way the algorithm works, you can kind of get into rabbit holes that are fascinating to you. And then if you become obsessed, perhaps you start to see those things in your real life. It reminds me of a Jeff Foxworthy joke, Chris. Remember Jeff Foxworthy when him and Larry the Cable Guy and all those guys?
I can't forget. The Mount Rushmore of those guys. Was Jeff Foxworthy.
Yep.
Ron White.
100%.
Larry the Cable Guy.
Yep.
And then who's the Here's Your Sign guy?
Bill Engvall. Yep.
Yeah, that defined comedy in the mid-2000s.
Fun fact, Bill Engvall is like enormously responsible for the rise of Jennifer Lawrence. He had like a one or two season show called The Bill Engvall Show, and I think that she played like his daughter or something. Look it up.
Wow, you're really?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I used to be a radio DJ, nobody in this, there are two types of people in this country that have the most knowledge about the shit that is the least relevant. Those are novelists and radio DJs, because you just sit there and look shit up all day. And I remember when Hunger Games came out, I want to talk about Jennifer Lawrence. I'm like, yeah, her and Bill Engvall or whatever. So anyway, I remember a Jeff Foxworthy joke where he is talking about how this hypochondriac culture of Dateline, and the joke was along the lines of he can't let his wife watch Dateline because she thinks she has everything, and he has to tell her, you do not have testicular cancer.
Does he follow that up with, you don't even have testiculars?
That's the punchline. Thank you very much. Good work, Chris. Soundboard is back.
I miss those days.
Yeah, those are great. Those are a great comedy group. But that's sort of the social contagion point. Everybody feels like a hypochondriac. WebMD does this. It scares the shit out of us, which WebMD is a great resource. It can really be like, I wish it would just have a thumbs up or thumbs down. Emergency room, make an appointment, right? Like, either go right now, you're going to die, or like, just talk to your doctor about it next time, you'll be okay.
It's like when remember when we were kids and they had the health fair at the school and they would go through all these things like brush your teeth and eat vegetables, and there was the one about like head lice.
Yep. Yeah.
They had people go in there and like screen like who has head lice, who doesn't, yep. And everybody's head, scalp were just itching like crazy. Everyone's like, oh my God.
Totally.
This is the day I find out I've been carrying head lice this whole time, and nobody has it.
Right. So if you have these TikTok algorithms, it's not just Jeff Fox with his wife watching a Dateline special about testicular cancer. It's like children watching people that have other diseases. And I think that one of the great things about TikTok is it's brought a lot of awareness for people, a lot of people with disabilities and different kind of marginalized groups, kind of show what their life is like. I follow a number of people like that, Native American people that just like show like, hey, this is what I got going on in my corner of the world. The problem is that when there are behavioral things, we've noticed something crazy happening in like 2019, 2020, that it really got out of control 2020, 2021, was that mostly girls, it appears like from my brief research, were starting to kind of develop psychosomatic fake-ish Tourette's syndrome. So you're following people with genuine Tourette's, and then either consciously or subconsciously or like semi-consciously starting to mimic that behavior, and then they can't stop these tics.
Yeah, that's a really interesting phenomenon. You know, I do like learning about the way that people live, especially when it's like, well, you know, this is somebody's lifestyle or somebody's career or whatever. And of course, you know, people who are, you know, living differently abled, are, yeah, that's a huge learning experience for people who otherwise wouldn't meet folks who are like that and have to deal with that sort of thing every day. But one of the things that kind of troubles me about TikTok and social media in general is it's a great way to connect people, and it's a great conduit for information and learning and people to meet up and be together and talk about mutual interests and all kinds of stuff. But it also leaves people open and susceptible, I think, to a specific kind of influence. And so what you're talking about here is the type of influence where people who are kind of, I don't want to say like vulnerable, groups of people who are impressionable,
sure,
I guess you could say,
yeah,
are consuming stories, and they're seeing, you know, on this platform, ostensibly there's some kind of like social credibility. It's people don't put this out there to humiliate themselves. They put it out there to, I don't know, gain attention, notoriety, yeah, instruct, help, just to positively engage with the world around,
yeah,
them. And so people see that, and especially young people can take that as a lesson. Oh, wow, well, this is really interesting. Maybe this is something for me. Maybe this is something for me to participate in. Maybe I have some other deeper connection to this kind of content, this type of person, this personality, this lifestyle, than I would have originally thought. And so what happens is, and you've shown the information, there's a record of people kind of adopting behaviors and patterns that they see exhibited on social networking sites like this.
Right.
And they start to think, oh, well, this is part of my life. And then they basically kind of fake their way, intentionally or otherwise, into having a fake disease. And it's a very strange phenomenon.
Yeah. So Tourette's is a really, and tick-like diseases, and specifically Tourette's, is a really interesting case of this because it's such a very specific and weird example. So for Jeff Foxworthy's wife cannot fake having testicular cancer without some very aggressive surgical changes to her body. But because Tourette's
and cancer.
Yeah, I think I've said there's a lot of in medicine pain-seeking patients who will kind of pretend to have chest pain or shoulder pain, and you can fake that, but you can't fake like the CT scan that shows that you have cancer. Like that's an actual thing. So 100%, like that's not as fakeable. We go back to like things like South Park where you just say you have Tourette's and then you can just cuss in class. That's an old bit that they did in like the 90s. That was like 25 years ago they did that bit. So this is not a new thing, but I also think that they're not doing what Cartman did in the episode of South Park. They are actually kind of like mimicking Tourette's like stuff, where instead of faking it and just saying a bunch of foul language, they're doing tick like behavior, and then maybe they do it on purpose, or maybe they think that they have it. In the same way that Jeff Fox with his wife can't will herself to having testicular cancer, these kids with Tourette's, you kind of can get locked in your brain. And then we're finding this wild reporting on this in medical journals of like people are essentially have psychosomatic Tourette's, and like it becomes a thing, like they can't stop doing it.
Psychosomatic meaning?
Psychosomatic means it's in your head and not in like your. So for example, like I don't want to say Crohn's disease, but like irritable bowel syndrome, for a lot of people that's just has something to do with stress, and it's in their head, and it may or may not be like an autoimmune situation. It may be like a brain situation.
So the symptoms that a patient reports to experience are real, but they're not necessarily like physiological. Like somatic is like the reference to the body.
Yeah.
But the symptoms are true, but they're, okay, so it's like a neurology type of situation.
Right, exactly.
So it's not someone goes to the doctor and says, I have, you know, my bowels are irritable.
Right.
It might be a case of where they like have like a Crohn's disease or right, some kind of digestive problem.
Exactly.
Or it could be a case that their brain is causing stress or but the point is it's a psychological thing that's manifest in the body rather than a physical disease that's resulting in
right, and
like anxiety.
For physicians, this sword is really difficult because there are a number of very specific examples where bias and things can kind of influence. And we know there's a big debate right now about chronic Lyme disease, where Lyme disease have been cured for many years, but people still have the symptoms of Lyme disease. And we don't know, has your immune system been completely rewired, or is this just a brain thing where you just can't understand that you don't have Lyme disease anymore? Another really great example of the problems of psychosomatic diagnoses are, of course, that for decades, maybe centuries, doctors have told women that they have a bad case of nerves or they just have anxiety. Like, oh, actually I had autoimmune disease. Oh, no, that was actually brain cancer. So, like, if you just assume things are psychosomatic, maybe you overlook something that's an actual disease. But also, if you treat it like an actual disease, like if you treat someone with psychosomatic Tourette's, is it going to be different than treating them if they actually have a diagnosis of Tourette's? And, like, what even is Tourette's? Does it have to be brain activity? Or maybe if you think you have Tourette's and you do Tourette-like stuff, then you have Tourette's. Like, that's sort of the complexity of when things are psychosomatic. The irritable bowel syndrome one is the kind of the easiest one to understand. Cause like, oh, no, you don't have an autoimmune disorder. You're having a tough time right now. Maybe you're not eating right and there's some things going on and we can fix it that way.
Okay. So it sounds to me like, so this is like the individual component of like when, yeah, how diseases or in some cases like behavior. So we're talking about contagion here specifically because this is like, it's connected to diseases and the way that diseases spread in networks. And I think, you know, there's a history of using that word that draws it back to like actual, you know, plagues and infections and how those infections spread.
Sure.
But the psychosomatic dimension of this is like how the individual could respond to various stimuli in the environment that might drive them to like change their behaviors. And you talk about Tourette's, like there are symptoms that are not behavioral, but many of the symptoms of Tourette's are behavioral, whether they're voluntary or not.
Right.
So what this New York Times article that we're looking at here, which is an article written by, looks like Azeem. Sorry, the font's too small for me to read.
Goriyashi.
Azeem Goriyashi, and then photography by Amber Bracken.
Bracken, yep, got it.
So that's from earlier this year. It was updated in June of 2023. So when you look at that story and you see, okay, here are children who are ostensibly consuming media and learning behaviors and then developing those behaviors as their own, that's clearly a social thing here. So let's talk about what a social contagion actually is and how this goes from the individual to like a broader social networking angle. And then we can get into some kind of game theoretic stuff with that.
Yeah.
So according to a publication in Current Opinions in Psychiatry from May, 2023, this is written by Vania Martinez, Alvaro Jimenez Molina, and Monica M. Gerber. Social contagion is defined as the spread of behaviors, attitudes, and affect through crowds and other types of social aggregates from one member to another.
Okay.
Then they elaborate, adolescents are prone to social contagion because they are especially susceptible to peer influence and peer media. So the definition here is coming from a report where in the findings of the article, they're looking at findings on social contagion and they're comparing that to violence and suicide among adolescents. And the findings that these three authors had in this report suggest that violence, bullying, cyberbullying, violent offending, and suicide are all propagated by social contagion. Their findings are inconclusive on the effects of video games and how often children are exposed to video games and how that correlates to violent behavior.
Yeah.
But the point is that social contagion can drive a lot of things. It's not just like diseases or like personal problems.
Right.
It's like real, genuine social problems like bullying and aberrant interpersonal relationships, violent offenses, suicide, really serious stuff that goes beyond one's own like personal experience and presents to society. Like, no, this is like a real problem.
Yeah. So, and there are a lot of examples of young people, like you said, impressionable people, which makes a lot of sense because for the majority of your life before you get to be like 12 years old, you're just growing. Children, like, oh, you're getting so big. Like, literally, your body doubles in size, your brain doubles in size, and you're just gaining knowledge. That seems like it slows down, but then after puberty, you just become like a sponge. You're learning, you know, you're learning so much, so something becomes new and fascinating, so you become obsessed with it. But children aren't the only ones that can get away with this. I remember watching an episode of House that had a really great example of social contagion. You think that there is some sort of bacterial infection on a plane. It's like everybody that has this has a tremor in their left hand, and they have an itchy ear, and then if you see everybody in the plane scratch their ear, like, no, you idiots don't have this. You know, you don't have crush syndrome from scuba diving. You just are freaking out because you're all in this plane. Like that kind of thing is like an easy example of this, but it can be significantly more complex than just exhibiting physical signs of a disease. It has a lot to do with money. There are suicidality and self-harm issues is one way that people kind of get obsessed with this. It becomes geographically clustered, but the reason that the TikTok thing is so scary is it's not geographically clustered. It can be everywhere.
Yeah, it really expands on what was already an existing phenomenon. That house episode, by the way, is awesome.
Great, I think, episode.
It's really interesting. It's where I learned about the bends and scuba diving. So
totally, me too.
Shout out to the scuba divers out there. I had no idea that was a thing. And that was a really interesting premise because, like you said, everybody on the show is on a plane. Mm-hmm. They're in this closed-in tube where you think, oh, shoot, if somebody's sick here, then we could all get it. And if it's really infectious, we could all get it. Actually, shout out to COVID for showing us that with a well-ventilated airplane, it's actually quite safe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, regardless, the phenomenon of social contagion does predate social media. And it's not, like you said, it's not exclusive to teenagers. There's an example from an article in Psychology Today authored by Clara Riggio that talks about social contagion and how one's own behavior can affect others and how one can be affected by the behavior of others. And there's this interesting example for this famous June bug case from 1962. Have you heard about this?
No, I have not.
So, quoting from the article here, in June of 1962, dozens of workers in a textile factory came down with the same physical symptoms: rashes, numbness in the hands and feet, and episodes of nausea. It was initially believed that the factory had been infected with some sort of toxic insect that had bitten the workers, and it became known as the June bug epidemic. But as it turns out, that wasn't really the case. There wasn't some mysterious bug that had snuck in and attacked all the workers who were experiencing these symptoms. It was actually a form of mass hysteria. It was a classic case of social contagion. Workers developed these psychologically induced symptoms. So it's the, psychosomatic. Mm-hmm. They all developed these psychosomatic symptoms around the same time. And when they came up with a plausible explanation, when someone said, oh my God, this must be like a, this looks like a bug bite. This is driven by something. We're all getting it. When somebody came up with that, a lot of other workers were influenced by that behavior. And so they developed the same complaints as the disease, mm-hmm, in quotation marks, that was being spread from worker to worker. And that's a perfect example to illustrate what a social contagion actually is. You know, these aren't like kids who are learning behavior from the internet. The internet was, I mean, it wasn't even a twinkle in Al Gore's eye in 1962. So yeah, it is a feature of the way that networks are established. And you know, you said that one of the scary things about the TikTok thing is that it's widespread. You know, anybody that can get on TikTok or any other social platform and see that, well, they can be influenced by it. But this was a case where, like, the network that these people were in this one textile factory in 1962, that network was kind of, it was the location of manifestation of this psychosomatic disease. There was no June bug, there was no epidemic, but it was a case of mass hysteria, and people really did feel like they really did experience those symptoms, although the symptoms were driven by the brain and not the body.
Which is so amazing to me that is even possible, that you can just like will yourself to have symptoms. And like to say the brain is misunderstood, we still have no idea. There are these weird placebo effects from surgeries where they just like open them up and then close them, and then they think their heart is fixed and then their heart is like fixed. I mean, I forget the exact situation that was happening in England, but there are like placebo effect surgeries, which is crazy. So we have no idea how that can even happen, but we do know that from these kind of contagions and these mass hysterias, there are a number of different types of them, which I kind of find interesting. This is from Wikipedia: disinhibitory contagion, echo contagion, and hysterical contagion. Disinhibitory contagion, I think, is an interesting one and is particularly dangerous for teenagers and adolescents. It's where you, the individual, has a desire already to emote or do the behavior, like Tourette's or, say, self-harm or suicide or something, and then you see someone do it, and now you're disinhibited. Like, you're like, oh, okay, this is how this can kind of, this can become a thing. Echo contagion is when there is a spontaneous imitation of a behavior with an emotional state shared by others. So it's like when you all do it at the same time. Hysterical contagion is when it's unwanted from a group or from an unknown means. Like, it just kind of happens. It's different from disinhibitory contagion and echo contagion because what's being transmitted may not be desirable. So that's what these TikTok ticks are kind of about, where it's not desirable. It just kind of happens to you because you're watching it or you're getting interested. And the June bug thing is kind of like that as well. They're not being disinhibited to try to fake having a disease. They're seeing someone have a thing and they're like, I could have that thing. Well, you didn't catch Tourette's and you didn't catch the bends. You are freaking out, and that's sort of what happens. But it goes beyond medical stuff as well. There are some examples of positive contagions where there's research out of somewhere about 20 years ago that you are more likely to report being happy if you have a friend who's happy within a mile from your house. You're like 25% of people were more likely to report being happy, and 34% of people were more likely to report being happy if their neighbors were their friend and they were happy.
Really? So it's like a social dynamics thing where people have in mind, like, oh yeah, somebody who's close to me, whom I think about often, like I know they're a happy person, so I'm pretty happy too.
Yeah, exactly. That's literally exactly what has happened.
Yeah, so the definition that we read earlier of social contagion does include that. I mean, it's not just behaviors. It's not just like symptoms of what you would experience like a disease. It's also emotions. People do report that. So that, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And what was the first disinhibitory was the word?
Yeah, disinhibitory contagion. It's where you may already want to do. So the exact, to quote Wikipedia, disinhibitory contagion involves a type of behavior that the person already has some desire to engage in, but from which normally they would refrain due to the desire to comply with social norms.
So this is like a classic, this is where that phrase, you become who you hang around.
Yes, exactly.
This is where that comes. So if you're hanging around people who are trying to, like, they're go-getters, they're trying to be their best person every day, they're trying to be kind to others, they're helpful, they keep their shit together, like if you have roommates, if they're clean, if they're respectful of people's boundaries and all that kind of stuff, you're going to start to take on a lot of those behaviors too. But if there's some way where you're like, you know, I'm not a person who does the dishes right away. I let everything soak, quote unquote, before I try to clean out the pans. I order out and eat fast food pretty often. If I've left my own devices, I pretty much just like watch TV or do whatever, right, or sit on my phone. If you're around other people who also do that, what you're saying is this kind of social contagion is you are given permission to indulge in your worst impulses. And that's everything from that's benign from like sitting around and doing nothing to like real serious, like, no, I have, you know, suicidal ideation, or I have the desire to whatever the case is,
right.
It can be really serious things. And so being around people who are also doing those behaviors and experiencing those emotions, that can draw out the same feelings and behaviors in the self.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's something called the nudge theory, and the nudge theory is kind of, maybe we could do an episode on the nudge theory one of these days. It's kind of a complex idea about behavioral economics, decision-making, policy, psychology. A lot of work has been done, say, with drug addiction and kind of social networks where someone is sort of neutral and maybe they're trending this way or that way and they need a nudge some way. Like, what is a small incentive? Or maybe the incentive is social instead of logistics, like money, like a little bit of a nudge. And how does that impact people in a positive or negative way? And we can kind of see that the nudge theory, in addition to these kind of decision-making webs in your social network and contagion, can kind of help people positively or negatively. And that's your neighbor, right? Like, that's when the neighbor's like, okay, well, let's go, let's have a backyard barbecue. And like, okay, well, I had a backyard barbecue today and we're social animals, like was what we started with. So that's positive for me. And it also, like, the drug addiction thing is really fascinating too. The famous laboratory rat experiment where rats, like 90-something% of rats would rather get addicted to like cocaine or heroin than eat, and then they would die. All of those rats were kept in isolation. There is a competitive study from someone in Europe about 20 years after that, where given access to food and drugs in a thriving environment of fellow rats, the rats didn't get addicted at anywhere near the level that human beings get addicted. They kind of ignored. Some people did it and some rats didn't, but like in a social network where there was food and complexity and they were like mating and stuff, it wasn't anywhere near a social problem. And now we can kind of see maybe the underlying issues of drug addiction. So we've like between the nudge and the social contagion and the positive aspects of social contagion, that people are using it for the rehabilitation of criminals and drug addicts and to kind of improve society. Because, you know, left to your own devices, maybe heroin feels better than not heroin, but going for a backyard barbecue or doing heroin, you're like, yeah, maybe I'll go to the barbecue today instead. Like, that's sort of literally the idea here, that seeing someone else do something, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and you know, if this was a podcast about like the philosophy of what's right and wrong, I would, you know, I'm sure. I'm a big believer in like personal responsibility. I don't think to say somebody's just like a victim of circumstances or like they couldn't help participate in the system, like that's kind of dehumanizing to people. It treats them as basically bundles of complexes, sure, who are situated in time and place. But that said, it's also naive to ignore the realities of the social networks. I mean, the examples you're giving are perfect illustrations of the kind of the really the game theoretic dynamics that are at play when it comes to social behavior. And so, Nick, I want to talk about a book that draws out exactly the kinds of examples that you're discussing.
Let's
here.
Do it.
I just happened to start reading it recently. It's called Connected.
Okay.
Let's see right here.
Wow. And how? Wait. Where did we get it?
We got this at a class that I'm taking for professional development.
That's
which is
so
a nice,
annoying.
You know, a little perk of my job.
Stop going to this class.
So this book is called Connected. It's how your friends' friends' friends affect everything you feel, think, and do. It's written by Nicholas Christakis, which is a fun name combo for us, and James Fowler. So these guys wrote this book. Christakis and Fowler wrote this book in 2009, I think, and there have been a couple of editions. This was a 2011 edition, and they talk about the way that social networks that we described the topology of networks before when we talked about your friends are more popular than you are, and remember that was a result of the shape of how networks actually look. It's not just that you're a loser and your friend you're only surrounded by super cool people. It's that the geometry of connections of nodes and linkages that has specific mathematical features which on average result in higher number of second order connections than first order connections. Well, these guys are saying similar dynamics are at play here when it comes to social contagion, especially when you're looking at behaviors. So, Nick, your example of people feeling happy when their friends and neighbors around them are happy, mm-hmm. that's exactly what Christakis and Fowler find. They do a number of studies here. They look at sexual behavior in adolescents and young adults. They look at the obesity epidemic, and that's really a perfect one to kind of illustrate this point.
Sure.
So they talk about the obesity epidemic in the United States, and they look at, you know, obesity rates are going up, and there's a higher than usual prevalence of that condition. And they talk about the idea of contagion. You can't, you know, the what's that Larry the Cable Guy joke where he's celebrating the birth of his kid or something, or celebrating somebody's birth, and they're having those like candy cigarettes. Like, yeah, we had so many of them candy cigarettes, I got secondhand diabetes.
That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, so like obviously you can't really catch diabetes, but so what these guys are looking at is rates of participation in the behaviors that contribute to obesity, like overeating, under-exercising, and stuff like that. And they basically find the same thing. And they find the same thing as in the happiness study, I should say, where people who spend time in the company of others who indulge in the same behaviors get the same exact results. And there's this phenomenon that they talk about here. And I want to try to find it on this page because on page 26 of this book, they have kind of one of the main theses of this. And this is really interesting because this isn't something that you could kind of like suss out.
Citing your sources to a page number is annoying. Let's lower the bar again, huh?
Okay.
Thank you.
On some unknown page
thank
of
you.
Some unknown right. source that
please
I
continue.
Invented.
Please continue.
Okay. So this is, I think, one of the most interesting findings that I've had in my looks at game theory and networks and stuff. And we've been doing this for 89 episodes. So
which is crazy.
This is really interesting.
2.5 years.
Yeah. It's, well, shout out to us. Now, shout out to you, player two. The thesis that these guys advance is that most people have a social network that expands out to roughly 6 degrees of separation. So you've heard of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get to most people basically around the globe. Like if you were to add, so there have been multiple experiments, one of them by Stanley Milgram, where you can pretty much connect to anybody around the globe within 6 degrees of separation. So you know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy, I think. And that can get you to basically anywhere. And so Stanley Milgram did this experiment in the 60s. And it was like a couple hundred people who lived in Nebraska. And he said, okay, send letters to this guy in Boston, which is more than 1,000 miles away. So these people who participated in the study were asked to send a letter to somebody that they knew personally and ask them to send it to somebody that they knew personally and so on and so forth. And the goal is to get some relationship with this particular businessman in Boston, these randos in Nebraska. And the number of hops from person to person that the letter took to reach the package was tracked. On average, 6 hops were required. Mm. So 6 degrees of separation. However, and this is the really interesting thing, Christakis and Fowler found that 6 degrees of separation connect people, but influence is driven by 3 degrees of separation. So your friends is friends is friends. Hence the subtitle of the book, your friends is friends is friends. And that has all sorts of implications for social behavior and emotions and participation in society and contagion and all that. It's that third degree of separation that's the most influential. So we started this with what I thought was a pretty good segue by you.
Sure. Yeah, perfect. Thank you, Travis Kelce.
Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift, hugely influential. NFL numbers are going up. Great. Excellent stuff. But what these guys find is that when you're dealing with stuff like social problems, like obesity, mm-hmm. like violence, like the spread of STDs, the things that matter are not necessarily the one-way conduits of information where people are consuming information and not participating in any way. The things that matter are those 3 degrees of influence, especially your friends' friends and your friends' friends' friends. So they recommend in this a strategy to deal with the obesity epidemic.
Okay.
And so their plan is basically like, okay, well, you join a club or something,
yep.
and get your friends' friends to join the club and get their friends to join the club. And that third degree of separation, if those people, like that third degree is like people who run all the time,
yeah.
then the club is going to be filled with runners eventually. The influence effects really tend okay. to. Yeah. So what they find is the drivers of social change and the drivers of behavioral adaptation, the way that the network is structured, it has a huge amount of momentum through those first 3 degrees, and then it really drops off. So you can't really, it's difficult to get to affect change beyond that third degree of separation, not because of like, well, you know, people just stop listening or whatever, but the geometry of the networks, like the basis of the connections becomes much weaker farther out, and it becomes too weak to really count on.
Yeah. Okay. So that's influence. That's one of the things about the 6 degree thing that I thought, like, well, what is know someone and what is know of someone? Like, I was just thinking, like, could I connect to people in China? I was like, yeah, I know some people who are either first or second generation immigrants and things. Like, okay, you can get there, but like, does the person that they're going to hook me up with, okay, so maybe we both have a symmetrical relationship. Like, I know my friends and they know their friends. But then beyond that, like, I'm just taking some people's word for it at this point. Like, that's not a degree of separation. That's like a flimsy piece of yarn in the Charlie Day thing. Like, that's not real, right? So, but in what you just said, where eventually the people who are experts in a thing that you're trying to change are going to show up because people do know that, people do know people that already do this kind of stuff. So I think that chess is a really good example of that, or any sort of game or hobby, that eventually you're going to stumble on people that are like, oh yeah, I've been playing Pokemon for 30 years. I know exactly what to do. We'll watch this, right? So it kind of makes everything a little bit more filled with a variety of expertise and can influence the people who want to become better at something because they already have the knowledge. So no one has to teach anybody. You're just surrounded by these people.
Yeah, it's the difference between interest, I guess, or yeah. connection and influence. Influence is much, much more difficult to propagate just because of the shape of networks. I mean, once you right. get to those fourth and fifth and sixth order connections, you're right. I mean, your actual connection to a person is only, it's only transitory. It's really through weak ties. But there is a range of distance between you and other people in your social networks wherein those weak ties actually produce really kind of strong results. You know, and for whatever reason, you know, the immediate ties from person to person, like it can be hard to overcome the inertia of somebody's personal behaviors and preferences and patterns of life and all that kind of stuff. And that's especially true because in networks, remember, your friends' friends have more connections than you do on average. Yeah, like the higher order you go, on average, the more connections there are. So it can be difficult for one node to be influenced by those nodes immediately around it. But because of the three-dimensional nature of the connections, it can actually result in a more effective approach to changing somebody's
That's
behavior. And, you know, one of the other things that Christakis and Fowler note here, to bring us back to the TikTok stuff, the type of information that is conveyed through a network, it's not necessarily true that all, like, linkages are two-way streets. So you talk about, like, parasocial relationships that we have with celebrities, for example, or minor celebrities that we see on platforms like TikTok. That information is a one-way street when you're consuming. But there's this weird kind of, like, halting relationship between the consumer and the creator on a social networking platform, because anybody in theory can do this. Anybody can make a social media. I mean, look at what we're doing. We were podcast yep. listeners for years, and then here we are participating in that in the same way.
Clogging up the internet like good old-fashioned white guys in their 30s.
You are welcome, America. We are here to be the change that we want.
We're like
to see
the Kelce brothers without any success or talent.
I think that's a really good. Can we rebrand this?
The it's talentless, like the Kelce's podcast without successful talent.
Yeah, well, yeah. Make that the official tagline.
Yeah, I will do. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. I think the networking part of this is really interesting, and it's also just a strange phenomenon that we all understand as humans. You don't trust your friends as much as you trust a stranger at the airport. It is really weird that people just don't take advice. How many people have had to listen to someone's dating story or like been involved and like you should break up with them? Like, I don't know, and then they don't. You're like, okay, but then they talked to someone. In a game lobby playing COD or at the airport or something, and they broke up. Like, I've been saying it, dude. Like, I've been saying it. So it is the third, fourth, fifth degree of these separations that can kind of have influence over people. Maybe there's just some sort of skepticism that you assume the people around you are trying to benefit from in some way from your decision, or that you want to gain independence. Maybe you're like, I'm about body positivity. I don't want to be obese. Like, well, deep down, you don't want to be obese. You want to be less obese, even if you are obese and you're fine with it. Maybe you want to be less obese. You want to be more healthy. And maybe you want the people around you to not care about that kind of thing. Whatever it is, I think that there's a weird skepticism about your closest group of nodes, that even though there's trust and affection and love and all of that kind of thing, you're like, yeah, I don't know. But in reality, you should just shut up and we can all get better at that. So that part of this is really strange. I want to dive into a couple of to close out here as we get in towards spooky season, a couple of really interesting examples, I think, in a vacuum of social contagion that do involve game theory as well. A great example of this is the Salem witch trial phenomenon, right? So the first thing that happened in the Salem witch trials were there were these girls and they had something similar to Tourette's, some sort of behavioral situation going on. It was eventually theorized right now. I think it's called ergotism, which is a disease contracted by grain or rye in bread. Like, so there was a disease going around, but it impacted how people were moving and things. So these two little girls got it, and everyone's like, witches. And at that point, we have a social contagion problem, and we have a game theory problem, because, like, the way to not be accused is to accuse someone else. So I have to fucking participate. Otherwise, I'm going to be crushed under these rocks or thrown into a stream with my hands tied behind my back to prove I'm a witch, which is incredible that human beings, how far we've reasoned, where like, okay, let's tie your hands together, throw you in a lake, and if you escape, you're a witch, and if you don't and you die, you're not a witch. So I mean, like, at that point, that's not a very good game theoretical situation to be in. So you have to accuse everyone. However, these girls have actual symptoms from an actual disease that actually impacts people, but the people around them are starting to be like, fuck, have I been bewitched? Are they faking it on purpose to screw their neighbor over who they want to be murdered? Or are they like, I don't know, there are witches everywhere. So at this point, it's out of control. Out of control. And because there's never been anywhere in human history where something like this has happened. There have been witches and witchcraft.
Well,
go ahead.
Hang on now.
Yeah.
So in America, there was something else that was like this in like the 1950s, like the communist. McCarthyism.
McCarthyism. And of course, I had another example, the Satanic Panic of the 80s.
Ooh, that's an interesting that one I know less about. It was connected to like D&D and like rock and roll music.
Essentially,
or
like people expressing themselves in counterculture are like, they're Satan worshippers, they're gonna steal your children. False.
It's what people like to call moral panics.
Mm-hmm. It happened a lot. There's a really famous case of these three kids in West Memphis, Arkansas. They're called the West Memphis Three. There's a really great documentary series. It was going on. They were let out of prison when I was in Oxford, Mississippi. It was a huge story. Like, when I worked for the student media, we drove to Memphis for them to get out. People like the Dixie Chicks, A-list celebrities, have been trying to get them out for years.
They're just the chicks now.
Dixie Chick. Yeah, they
rebranded.
That's right. It's like Lady A. Everybody was involved in this. They clearly didn't do it, and someone kind of clearly did do it, but they were teenagers. They were those big, like, JNCO pants. They were emo, D&D in the 80s, and they're like, this is devil worship. They killed our children. Eventually, very sadly, the West Memphis Three took a plea deal where they admitted guilt instead of going to a new trial just so they could get out of prison. One of them was kind of a holdout, but, I mean, the state of Arkansas really screwed them. This is not a unique situation. A lot of people, like babysitters and stuff, are falsely accused of this Satanic Panic thing. It takes one Dateline episode, or I don't want to besmirch Dateline, whoever, for legal reasons.
Well,
whichever episode aired where people are like, these Satan worshipers are impacting my children, and we have to get these people out of there. There are people in prison now that have been like probably falsely accused of this kind of shit just because we were freaking out. And there's another thing happening now, and it's driven by TikTok. There's a lot of people are pretending that like a smudge on their car is a sign that they've been marked for human trafficking. Like, no, nope. Oh God, some people have, that does happen, but there is a social, and it's not as bad now as it was about a year ago. A lot of people are like, this, I came out of Walmart and there was a sticker on my car. It's like, it was probably an asshole. It probably wasn't, nobody's going to, no, it's not, that's not happening to you. And what's the awful thing about this, just like in Salem and just like with Satanic Panic, is that these kind of things hurt people who are actually victims of human trafficking, and they hurt people who are actually abusive to their children and then can blame the babysitter. This kind of shit distracts from what's actually going on. Like in Salem, they didn't know about germs at the time, but like cooking your bread better would have prevented all of this.
Yeah, it really does take away from the important issues. You know, the big example that I was thinking of was the Red Scare. Like the red or the red terror in Stalin's Soviet Union.
Yep.
I mean, you want to talk about a lose-lose game theory cycle. The well-being of you and your family depends on your ability to come up with enough accusations of infidelity or capitalist sympathies. Otherwise, like, you're going to be thrown into prison, or your family's going to be thrown into prison, or you're going to be shot. I mean, you can't win in a situation like that. And so I don't know if this is necessarily like a social contagion, because it's driven by a specific force, and that force is the state using a monopoly on force to basically bully people into ratting on their neighbors who may or may not have done anything right. And it leads to false accusations. So rather than trying to address the problems that are cropping up in a society like that, you spend all your time trying to evade the secret police and trying to figure out ways to rat on your neighbors without losing sleep at night.
Yeah, well, the contagion part of it, I think we're seeing it right now with conspiracy theories for things that we have scientifically proven for years. Again, the Flat Earth documentary, I can't recommend it enough, because it's very clearly an element of community and loneliness here at play, where they're like, they just want to be part of a group that is swimming upstream, and that part of it is really harmless. Like, it's just, they just want to believe in something. And is there any difference between believing the earth is flat and Greek mythology? Like, yes, for the reasonable person, but for them, that's just kind of this silly little fun thing that they want to be a part of. But for like what you're saying, the Red Scare, there are people that are actually buying the line, that are actually scared that there are communists everywhere. That's the contagion part. It's like in Salem, right? Like a reasonable person like me and you were farmers, and we were like, we got to fucking accuse someone, dude. Like, I know that there are no witches. I know that this is stupid. We got to accuse someone. Otherwise we're going down. Like, we're two men that live together. We got to find ourselves a witch. Otherwise we're going to be witch hunted. But there are also people in Salem who are like, the Lord is here. We're at war with these witches. So both things are, that's the game theory part of this. Like, both things are happening. There are people that were buying McCarthy stuff. I mean, I just watched White House Plumbers the Watergate stuff, which was unbelievably good show. 10 out of 10. Can't recommend enough. Have you heard about this show? Oh, so good.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, it's good. Awesome. Those guys that were doing it, like, they bought it. And like, I mean, the one guy's wife was like, this is so dumb. All of you are idiots. Like, this is ridiculous. That's part of this, right? So there are certain people who were completely understood what was going on, like McCarthy's doing this, that had to participate in the game. It's just, so you and I play yellow car, or we did growing up, like you have to play yellow car, otherwise you're going to get hit. So you have to have to hit first. So that's
a good point.
Drag people into this. Yeah.
Well, you talk about loneliness and uniqueness and people's desire to both conform and stand out. There's an interesting paper from Russell Goldman, Aaron Bugby, Aditi Jain, and Sonika Saraf, who are affiliated with Carnegie Mellon. They're in the social science department and the math department there, and then NYU as well. They wrote this paper in December 2020. They published it in December 2020. It's called Hipsters and the Cool, Game Theoretic Analysis of Social Identity Trends and Fads. And this is really good. It's a robust mathematical look at the game theory dynamics that are at play when people try to participate in cultural trends yet retain uniqueness. So just reading from kind of their findings here. They say, we propose a theory of social identity expression based on the opposing but not mutually exclusive motives to conform and to be unique among one's neighbors in a social network. We find that the dynamics typically enter random walks or stochastic limit cycles rather than converging to a static equilibrium. So they say
we know what random walks are. Oh,
that's right.
Player three does.
Yeah. That's right. Player three, you know what we're talking about with a random walk. It's not like we're going to converge on a Nash equilibrium here. We're just going to continue until we eventually cross all of the lines and the social dynamics are going to continue kind of ad infinitum. Mm-hmm. Then we show they go on by saying we show that nuanced psychological assumptions, recognizing preferences for uniqueness along with conformity. So these nuanced psychological assumptions and realistic social network structure are both critical to our account of the emergence of complex, unpredictable cultural trends. In other words, the shape of the network that people are in and the competing desires that people have in their brains to conform and stand out, those are the foundations of social dynamics that produce not a static equilibrium, but a continually evolving, dynamic, and unpredictable social environment.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. You know, your participation in society is in large part shaped by your personality, but it's also in large part shaped by the nature of the network that you happen to be in. So when your neighbors are happy, you're more likely to be happy because the network says so. If your neighbors are experiencing tics and you're consuming only tics because you're locked in your house and your social network is limited to the internet and your family, and you want to spend time on the internet because you're a teenager, then you're going to start to develop tics, and they're not going to be explicable by any other means other than social contagion. That's just the way that networks work.
Yeah, and like you see it around you. How many small towns in throughout the last 150 years have been randomly good for 20 years at, say, something like chess or like in Green River? We had in Green River, Wyoming, which is where we're from, there was an aggressively talented and well-functioning metal music scene, and like everybody wants to be in a band, but like there were multiple, they were touring, like they made money, like, and this was like how well, it takes like five people and then it spreads and it spreads and it spreads and it spreads, and who knows who actually likes music, who adapts to it, who wants to play in a band. All of a sudden there are four metal bands in a town of 12,000 people and there aren't any country bands or rock bands. It's just like this one thing. There's like a scene because people are seeing this kind of thing happen. So to wrap up and go back to the Tourette's thing, in this New York Times article that is talking about how they get over it, it took a long time for some of these kids to get into therapy. They got to go to real therapy. It's very simple. There are two things that have to be understood. Thing number one is that they do not have Tourette's, and that their twitches and the tics are partly under their control. And that's the thing that kind of gets you out of this, is like, we know for sure you don't have June bug syndrome. You're doing this to yourself. It becomes like you're in this brain cycle of like, it's honestly, it's very similar to Inception. I think all of the Inception is a smarter movie than people think it is. Like if I make you think about elephants, you're thinking about elephants, but then how do you wake up out of this, like, I am alive now thing? Like, okay. And I imagine that there's a feeling of nakedness, that part of like having this disease that you can't control is exciting to people who didn't have anything going on. Kind of like what you said, they kind of walked into this corner of the internet and now this thing is happening to them that they're doing to themselves, and just spins and spins and spins. Then you take off, the sleep mask that DiCaprio was wearing, and you're like, oh shit, life is boring again.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly right. Think about the social dynamics at play in the paper we just talked about.
Right.
People have the desire to conform, which is to say to gain social credibility, but they also have the desire to stand out, which is to say to be different or valuable in some way. So it in some way, those competing interests put people in a position where, like, if your life is boring, if you all you can do is rely on the love and support of your friends and family and those you care about most for fulfillment, not everybody is really interested in that. I think people get bored a lot, especially teenagers. You know, when you're young and immature, it's harder to appreciate the fact that love is meaningful and it's significant. So when people do get bored and they start to think about, like, well, maybe there's something else going on here. Maybe there's some other mystery that I need to plumb. And then the network space comes along where they can say, ah, yes, this must be for me. I must be participating in this social trend because this explains all these impulses that I've ever had. The hard truth to swallow, I think, for a lot of people in a lot of times and places, is that not every single experience that you have is valid or consistent with the real world around you. Just because something feels really true and really authentic and really genuine and really that does not mean that it is actually true. There is not necessarily convergence when it comes to the real world and one's own experience in it. And when it comes to networking, sometimes people have. Well, actually, I'm glad you bring that up because
I'm making the triangle thing.
It's not this book. It's a different book. I had to read a different book for this class. But here's another way to describe the triangle thing. Functionally, when it comes to network analysis, I don't know that this is an accurate depiction of reality, but basically there's like a triangle thing that sounds very similar to the experience, reality, and fact, the Nick Andrews patented
triangle. It's truth, fact, and reality. It is the
truth, fact, and reality.
The game theory experience triangle. Thank you very much.
I like that. Game theory, that's trademarked, probably.
Of course. And I will absolutely be fighting people in court. Thank you.
Yeah, here we go. But so basically when people experience reality, what, you know, the psychologists often say, the thing that's going to determine the interaction that they have is actually a mental image of the real world that they perceive. Yep. So as you're listening to this, player three, you're developing a mental picture of what we're talking about. And it's that picture that you have to represent to others if you want to communicate with them.
Sure.
And then others have to interact with your representation of the picture in your mind of the real world. And so it's all about like symbols and abstractions.
Totally.
And you participate in this. You can, you know, see with your eyes and hear with your ears and touch with your body, whatever. You can experience the world, but at best, all you have is an imperfect mental picture. And it's like a game of telephone between your interpretation and your communication and somebody else's interpretation of your communication. And then their own creation of the mental picture. The point is that engaging with these kind of mental abstractions creates a version of reality that is useful for people to try to understand and make their way in the world, but is not necessarily exactly reflective of the way the world works. And sometimes there's space in between those two things, between the true like nature of the world and between people's mental constructs of it, for ideas like flat eartherism to get
yes.
in. For ideas like maybe I have Tourette's when you absolutely don't have Tourette's. Like right. there's space sometimes for those things to sneak in. And sometimes the shape of networks kind of widens that gap and allows it to fill one's own space more freely. And so that's where you get things like psychosomatic symptoms from the 1962 June bug epidemic.
Exactly.
And so it can be a real serious issue. And you're right. The first step to dealing with this on a person-to-person basis is understanding that just because something feels really authentic to me doesn't mean it actually is. And second, I am often in control of my mental state, so I am responsible for understanding this and dealing with the implications of that fact.
Yeah. So the experience triangle is equilateral in my brain, and the way that it works is there are three points: truth, reality, and fact. So for example, we look at the Lyme disease thing, and be like, a physician can test for the bacteria and say, you do not have Lyme disease, period. The person's like, I have all of the symptoms of Lyme disease. I have Lyme disease. That is both factual and true. The reality is somewhere in the middle, and the narrator gets to decide what's happening. So the doctor can be like, you don't have Lyme disease. And the person can say, I do have Lyme disease. One is factual, one is true, and one is, and in the middle, they're real. It's like the doctor's like, this person is freaking out. They don't have Lyme disease. This person's like, I do have Lyme disease. And the doctor's like, factually, no. Person's like, but in truth, I do. I'm not lying about what's happening to me. And so you can miss, and that's, you know, that's a chronic thing, and I don't wish that on anybody. But for how you experience the world, the hardest thing to understand is that we're all just unreliable narrators. We're all just, you know, there's a plot twist coming at the end where your therapist reveals to you, like, actually, you've been the problem the whole time, Taylor Swift.
Well, there's the exact opposite of this case too. I mean, there are reports. I remember there was this nurse in South Dakota in 2020 or 2021 who would talk about patients who were dying of COVID, who were vehement deniers of the seriousness of the disease, who were vehemently anti-vax, who propagated it, who didn't wear masks, who didn't social distance, who didn't do all the precautions necessary to stop the actual contagion from infecting people who were vulnerable. And these people would get sick. And this nurse said she had multiple experiences of people who were dying, literally on their last breaths, who were denying that they had COVID. They said, No, it's not real. I can't have it. And there they are. They're fully, fully dying. And they died moments later. And to their last moment, they denied that they actually had the disease. And so it's, you know, it can be a real serious, dangerous problem when people are, that's why you shouldn't necessarily just like try, like, well, if so-and-so says that they're experiencing this, then you have to believe, like, that's not necessarily always true. Like our depictions of reality are not necessarily reliable. Like, you're right. Like, we're all pretty unreliable narrators to ourselves to one degree or another. And when it starts to leak out into social space and influence the behaviors of others, especially in an aberrant way, then it becomes a real problem. And it's up to networks and positive network influences, those 3 degrees of separation. It's up to that to try to address the issue. And Nick, I think we'll close it out here by coming back to what I think might be a practical way to address the network problem. I'm going to explain what Club Penguin is. Club Penguin.
Yes, finally, God.
Massive multiplayer online role-playing game. It's a virtual world that contained a range of online games and activities created by New Horizon Interactive. Players used cartoon penguin avatars and played in Antarctic-themed open world. It's not the social network we deserve, but it's the one we need right now.
Sounds like Minecraft in the early days, huh?
It was a precursor to Minecraft. Yeah, in my head canon, it was.
See, that's exactly right. To you, that's true. You didn't lie just now.
That's right. It's reality, baby.
Might have factually been wrong, but who cares? Just tell the truth, right? Just tell the truth, right? I swear to tell the whole truth. So much as I remember it, it may be factually complete bullshit, but I'm glad that everybody will decide a man's fate based on what I think I remember.
God bless the law.